Football Weekly is on the air.
This is Wayne Larrabee with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hob Arkush, senior editor Eric Edholm, and the Pro Football Weekly staff. Welcome to an in-depth look at professional football. Coming up, we take a look at the offensive side of the NFL draft.
The world champion New York Giants finally got busy last week. Asante Samuel trying to get out of Philadelphia, and is Jim Irsay running the Vikings now?
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
The Way We Hear It, featuring news and information gathered by the editors and reporters of Pro Football Weekly. And we begin this week with Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane. And Kevin, your beat, the New York Jets. Santonio Holmes is heading up the off-season workout program, and he's invited Mark Sanchez. I'm surprised, number one, Santonio Holmes is leading the off-season program. And number two, Sanchez, I guess that makes it news, the fact that he was invited.
Yeah, I know that the Jets aren't going to be on Hard Knocks, but wouldn't you love to see cameras there in Disney World with Santonio Holmes and Mark Sanchez playing catch with each other? You know, Dustin Keller, Patrick Turner were also there. You know, I think if you listen to Rex Ryan and Mike Tannenbaum, their kind of mantra all off-season has been improving team chemistry. They held down to Santonio Holmes. They gave Sanchez that kind of contract extension. The two of them need to be on the same page. Sanchez needs to kind of get the locker room back, and so does Santonio Holmes. So just looking at the fact that they're so big on team chemistry, this is obviously a good sign that the two of them are working out on their own voluntarily before the workouts begin next Monday. Is it going to translate to wins? That's another factor. But if you just look at what the Jets are hoping for this offseason, it's a positive sign.
I guess it's a good thing, Kevin, but is this more of like a gesture? Is this something that the team could have suggested highly that Santonio do in order to mend some fences here?
I'm sure that had something to do with it, Eric. And I'm guessing, Dustin Keller, I'm sure that some of these other players, Keller and Sanchez are very close. I'm sure he was trying to kind of mend fences between those two. And again, my thing all along has been, you can do whatever you want to fix that locker room, but the Jets also need a lot more talent on the field if they want to win games. And Santonio Holmes is the most talented playmaker they have on the team right now, and they need to do a better job getting him the ball, and he needs to do a better job, staying on the field and keeping up with the chemistry, and hopefully Tony Sperano, for their sake, helps out with that.
Let's also ask you about the Miami Dolphins, another one of your teams. Cameron Wake, one of the top pass rushers in the game, in the final year of a four-year contract, making about $700,000, which is less than half of what he should be getting at this stage. But the voluntary workout programs now that are getting underway across the league, Wake is an extremely hard worker, but is he going to boycott these workouts?
Well, he didn't show up at the first one, Wayne, and it doesn't look like he's going to be going to some of these. And it's a surprise because Cameron Wake is known as a gym rat. He's said before that these workouts are very important to him. He takes them very seriously. But he's also, you look at his pay, I was actually reading earlier that Jason Trusnik, his backup, actually is going to be making a higher base salary in 2012 than Cameron Wake. So you ought to understand where Wake is coming from. He obviously wants that new deal. And the Dolphins, Stephen Ross has said before, money's not going to be an option. The Dolphins have talked with Wake over the past couple of seasons. They are open to redoing the deal. The other thing, though, looming for Miami is Jake Long's contract is up at the end of the 2012 season. So you have your two best players that need big deals. This is not a team with a lot of cap space, especially right now. So nothing's going to happen in the short term, but something to keep an eye on going forward. And the big question is going to be, when mandatory workouts start, is Wake going to be willing to lose that $30,000 to prove his point that he should be compensated better?
So, Kevin, here's the part of the story I guess I just don't get. I look at the Miami roster. Not only are Cameron Wake and Jake Long, not in that order, the two best players on the team, they're probably the only two players on that team I'd take if I was building a team. So where's all the cap space going? Who's getting all the money?
Yeah, well, it's been all over the place. And you look at the Brandon Marshall deal. You look at Carlos Dansby. There's one guy that a lot of people talk about. Maybe he should be restructuring his deal. He's got a pretty hefty contract. And see, he came into the season last year overweight. And then when he got back in shape, he helped the defense a lot. But there's a contract that I think a lot of people talk about when they look at the Dolphins cap situation. The thing is, for going after the 2012 season, they don't have a whole lot of money tied up in contracts. So they are going to be able to franchise one of them and get a long-term deal done. It's just they have to wait a while, and they also got to save some money for these rookie contracts coming up, because they could be paying, a number 8 pick quarterback as well.
Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane, thank you very much. Senior Editor Eric Edholm is with us. Eric, the Giants, one of your teams, they're suddenly busy. Been a quiet off season, and yet this week they've signed cornerback Antoine Molden and traded for Bengals linebacker Keith Rivers not long ago, the ninth pick in the NFL draft. Tell us a little bit about where they're at this stage of the season.
Yeah, well, Rivers had kind of been squeezed out in Cincinnati. He was sort of their fourth linebacker and, you know, just couldn't stay on the field because of injuries. He was the ninth pick, like you said, and they get him for the final pick in the fifth round. I'd say that's pretty good value for a young guy who's going to be 26 in a couple of weeks. Probably a weak side linebacker, and you say, okay, well, that's where Michael Boley played, and he played pretty well there last year. There has been some talk about moving Boley to the middle. Rivers also an option inside. The interesting sort of wrinkle to this is it sounds like they're willing to let Jonathan Goff go. He was injured all last year but started for the team in 2010. And also Chase Blackburn. I mean, he was an underrated piece of that defense. Everything kind of came together when they signed him off the street. Did a terrific job on Gronkowski in the Super Bowl. So sounds like they're willing to let some of these guys walk and maybe develop the young players they have as backups.
You know, I think the interesting thing about Rivers is not only was he the ninth player in the first round chosen, he played like it until he got hurt. I mean, you know, it's not like this guy busted out. He just couldn't stay on the field. And as you say, now they've brought in other people, but this could turn out to be one of the great moves of the offseason.
You hear it from other people around the league, and Jerry Reese does such a terrific job with that roster, and this is another example of a guy that, you know, if it doesn't pan out, they cut bait, but otherwise he could be a real steal.
We'll have more Way We Hear It coming up when Pro Football Weekly continues. You are listening to Pro Football Weekly, featuring the publisher and editor, Hub Arkush, senior editor, Eric Edholm, and the Pro Football Weekly staff. We pick it up with associate editor, Eli Cabron, on the Way We Hear It. Kansas City Chiefs. Hey, Eli, growing speculation the Chiefs could be in the market to draft a quarterback fairly early in this upcoming draft?
Yeah, Wayne, the Chiefs have the 11th pick in the draft, and a lot of people are speculating that they might want to move up into the top 10 and try to get Texas A&M's Ryan Tannehill. He has a strong arm. He's athletic. Perfect fit for Brian Doball's offense that the Chiefs are now running. The Chiefs haven't drafted a quarterback in the first round since Todd Blackledge in 1983, but they could be in a position to move up and get him.
I'll give you one scenario that my mind sort of created up here a minute ago. The Patriots pick 31st in the first round. We know their affinity for trading down. A couple years ago, they made that Matt Castle deal, involved a pick in the similar range. Obviously, they turned into Patrick Chung. What about the possibility of using their second round pick as bait and moving back into the late first round range? Is that something they would talk about for maybe a Brock Osweiler, a Kirk Cousins, somebody like that?
Yeah, that is a possibility, Eric. Kirk Cousins actually had a private workout with quarterbacks coach Jim Zorn, and I think that they are pretty high on him. The question about Cousins is the arm strength. That can he execute in that the vertical offense that they kind of want to run with Doball? It remains to be seen, but Matt Castle has 3 years left on his deal. I don't know if they're necessarily looking to replace him this year. I don't think either of those quarterback prospects are considered rookie starters. But if the Chiefs could get a young quarterback they can groom, they took Ricky Stanzi last year, but he could not even beat out Tyler Palco for playing time a year ago. So they could definitely be in the market either in the first round or moving back into the first round to get a guy like Kirk Cousins.
Yeah, that'd be a hell of a thing to have on your headstone. Couldn't beat out Tyler Palco. you know, Eli, getting back to Castle for just a minute, with 3 years left on his deal, you know, no, they're not trying to replace him this year, but you also don't draft quarterbacks high and have him wait 3 years usually. You know, there's not a lot of Aaron Rodgers out there. Is it a concern about Castle's health that he's been so injury-prone? Is Scott Pioli never been quite as fulfilled with him as he and Josh McDaniels expected to be, or what's the deal there?
Well, yeah, the question about Castle is that his play just seems to fluctuate. He did really well 2 years ago under Charlie Weiss, and then last year when Weiss was gone under Todd Haley's direction again, he kind of dropped again, and now Todd Haley's obviously gone, and Brian Doball is in charge, but they're kind of concerned with his consistency, and they brought in Brady Quinn as a backup. He's familiar with Doball and Romeo Crennel, but he's another example of a young quarterback that's never really proven himself. So there's a lot of question marks on the Chiefs depth chart, and it starts at quarterback because they just don't know exactly what they're going to get out of Castle every year.
And general manager Scott Pioli is not adverse to going into the draft and looking to fill a need with a specific pick, is he not?
No, last year they had a clear need at wide receiver, and they took Jonathan Baldwin in the first round, even though A lot of people thought that that was a bit early for him, but Pioli knew he needed a receiver and addressed that need. He did it a few years ago. He took defensive lineman Glenn Dorsey, took Tyson Jackson. They could have had Joe Flacco or Mark Sanchez, and they passed on those quarterbacks. So this might be the year that the Chiefs actually get a first-round quarterback.
Associate Editor Eli Cabron on the Chiefs. Eric Edholm is with us in studio, as we've mentioned, our senior editor. Philadelphia Eagles, another one of your teams, Eric. Contract info on Demetrius, formerly Demetrius Bell. Essentially a one-year deal, $3.5 million. Now, the last 4 years of the deal is kind of like funny money.
Well, yeah, I mean, he didn't get a signing bonus, and there's a roster bonus due prior to the 2013 season of like $8.5 million. Now, the chance of him getting that, even if he blows the Eagles' doors away, and I mean, you know, just completely impresses him, Jason Peters is going to be back. He may be back this season. So this is kind of a one-year Band-Aid, if you will. They didn't show any interest in Bell prior to Peters getting hurt and blowing out his Achilles. You know, there's obviously kind of a six-month window on this to find out where Peters is. But this is an insurance policy. I don't really think he's going to be a long-term solution. So I expect he'll probably be playing elsewhere next year.
What about Asante Samuel, Eric? He would like to be playing elsewhere. And actually, I don't know if he'd like to be playing elsewhere so much as he wants to make sure he gets the $10 million he's due on his contract. And probably at 31, thinks he may have a contract left in him. I don't know. I just know that on a team loaded with corners in terms of locker room fit, chemistry, and willingness to stick his head in a pile, he's probably the least desirable of the three at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, Samuel's probably more attractive elsewhere in the sense that, you know, he's kind of a zone corner, a gambler, a guy who would fit in a better system. The Eagles want to get back to running more man defense. I talked to Nnamdi Asamoah about that last week, and, you know, and he said they want to get to that press man coverage that he did a lot of in Oakland, and that suits his skills better. I think it suits Dominic Rogers' Cromartie skills better. I think the Eagles are trying to trade Samuel. I don't know what they can get for him. Like you said, that salary is very much prohibitive. You know, if a team can offer some sort of thing and rework his deal, get him down to the $4 or $5 million range, maybe a reunion in New England, there's got to be a team out there that needs his skills, I would think.
We'll have more news and notes in the way we hear it when we come back to this off-season edition of Pro Football Weekly. Welcome back to this off-season edition of Pro Football Weekly. This is Wayne Larrabee along with Hub Arkush and Eric Edholm. We're joined by Associate Editor Arthur Arkush, Jacksonville Jaguars. Well, I don't know quite how to go about this, Arthur. A guy by the name of Pot Roast is in a nightclub, gets into an altercation, now has an eye injury. Tell us, give us an update first off on Terrence Knighton's eye injury.
Well, I'll fill you in as much as I can, and the details in this situation remain kind of sketchy at this point, but what we do know is that there was an altercation that occurred in the wee morning hours on Sunday night, and he sustained an eye injury. There are conflicting reports. His agent said that he was trying to break up a fight, but we do know there was some kind of physical altercation that occurred. So there was a police report filed. However, it was an information report filed by an off-duty police officer. The NFL has already said that since no charges are expected to be filed, they are staying out of this. It's up to the Jaguars if they decide to do anything. That's kind of where things stand. It's said to be a serious injury, but not career-threatening and not with long-term ramifications. So he is going to make a full return to health. We haven't found out when that's going to be.
Yeah, you know, if I'm in a fight and I see a guy named Pot Roast coming, I just stop. So I don't think he got hurt trying to break it up. But again, we don't really know the facts of the deal. The other Jaguar story that was interesting, Arthur, is apparently they have interest in the HBO Hard Knocks show. You know, when you think of likely candidates, somehow you don't think of those cameras ending up in Jacksonville.
No, I don't think so. And nonetheless, it is encouraging that they are showing an interest, and that Shad Khan, the new owner, of course, of that club, has said from the outset, since he gained control, that he wants to make the Jaguars more visible and that he's going to do whatever it takes to kind of, you know, help them sell more tickets, help them become a more regional and national brand. So the fact that they're showing interest and have reached out to HBO to express interest is certainly encouraging and is a bit of a departure from the way the Jaguars have done things in the past.
Well, that's a platform where they could get more recognition, Arthur, but I don't know how many people would be watching them. You know, that's the thing. They're not a compelling team to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right there with you. And it's with all due respect, I'm not sure that Gene Smith or Mike Mularkey are going to be the most colorful characters. And, you know, while Blaine Gabbert and Chad Henne competing for the starting job, having it out to see who's going to be under center, you know, I could think of things I'd rather watch. So,
although MJD's pretty good at foot and mouth disease.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he could give you a little bit to deal with. So it'll be a curious one to keep an eye on.
Let's move on to another one of your teams. And always interesting is Jim Irsay, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts, and he he's becoming more and more, at least on Twitter, in his own mind, a talent guru. And he's talking up Ryan Tannehill pretty hard. What's his motive here?
Well, we know that you know, Mr. Irsay likes to take to his Twitter account to talk about anything from classic rock lyrics to apparently now what a great evaluator he is. So he has called Ryan Tannehill a hidden gem and one of the best kept secrets in the draft. I've heard plenty about Ryan Tannehill. I'm guessing lots of others have too. But according to Jim Irsay, he's still a pretty well kept secret at this point. So anyway, you know, more smoke screens would be my guess. Just Irsay trying to flaunt his stuff as a personnel evaluator. Nothing has changed here. Andrew Luck is going to be the guy in Indianapolis, and the real question becomes what Ryan Grigson's going to do to put people around him.
Well, you know, obviously he's learned nothing from chasing the greatest quarterback in the history of the game out of town, not getting anything in return for him. And let me just read the quote here, the actual tweet.
Can you read a tweet, though? These things are very tricky to interpret here, yeah.
Well, I mean, I can read it. I don't know what it means. It says, quote, this is what he tweeted, "Tannehill is a hidden gem in this draft, a quiet secret who was always sneaking up to number three. You want him? You better talk to Ziggy the Biggie." Now, close quote, end of tweet. And I'm going to swing this over to Eric, who covers the Vikings. I have met Mr. Wilf. I don't call him Ziggy, and I don't call him Ziggy the Biggie. Now, I realize that the Jim Irsay is another owner, but I don't think Ziggy Wilf would appreciate being called Ziggy the Biggie, number one. And number two, anybody with half a brain who knows anything about football knows you can't use the number three pick in this draft on Ryan Tannehill. So, actually, Eric, before you jump in, Arthur, let me ask you, what the hell is Irsay thinking? Does he like being a clown, or what's going on here?
Well, you've asked me to get inside Jim Irsay's head, and that's a place I'm not sure I want to be and I could ever figure out what's going on inside.
Dangerous.
Of
this, so,
yeah. Never find your way out. Yeah.
I'm going to steer clear of that, but I think the day that we, you know, stop being surprised by some of the things that Irsay says and does, I just don't see that day coming anytime soon, so I'll leave it at that.
And Ziggy Wilf, I mean, you know, with all respect to him, he's not the one making the deals. I mean, Rick Spielman and Rob Brzezinski and people like that are the ones who are making these deals. Now, would Wilf be interested in what his team is doing with that number three pick? Absolutely. But, yeah, it's fascinating. I talked to Rick Spielman last week, and they're in more of a power position than maybe people thought a couple months ago. You know, he was openly willing to trade the pick, this and that. Everybody said, okay, they're going to end up with Matt Khalil, this left tackle from USC. That's their guy. Now there's a little more smoke to this fire, and I asked him about the possibility of trading it on the clock. If it got that deep into the draft where they had 6 minutes left and somebody came in, like the Dolphins, said, you know, we want Tannehill, we want to move up to three to make sure the Browns don't take him, he'd be open to a deal. And he said their draft board's going to be set, they're going to know what their value asks are going to be, what they want to get in return. It's still a possibility, maybe more so than I thought originally.
You know, guys, the interesting part of this, and Wayne will talk to Nolan about it in a minute, is I could see somebody coming up to number three for Matt Khalil,
right,
for Trent Richardson, you know, probably not Justin Blackmon anymore. But you can't give up what you'd have to give up for a wide receiver who's played a couple years a quarterback in a sketchy offense and not been that productive. I mean, I know a lot of people like Ryan Tannehill, but he's not the number three pick in this draft, not by a long stretch.
I don't think he's going to play for a couple years unless you're just forcing the issue on him.
Absolutely. Far from polished. Stay tuned. We've got the author of Pro Football Weekly's Draft Preview Guide joining us next when Pro Football Weekly returns. We are back on Pro Football Weekly. Senior editor Nolan Naraki is with us as we get ready for the NFL draft. He's the author of the Pro Football Weekly Draft Preview book. And Nolan, first off, again, welcome to the program. And secondly, let's start with the quarterback position. A lot of talk, of course, as you get closer and closer to the draft. We know about the top two guys. But beyond that, you know, there's discussion, as we just had in the previous segment, about Ryan Tannehill out of Texas A&M, Kirk Cousins from Michigan State. This next tier of quarterbacks, kind of clear that up for us. Where are they? Where do they sit on your board?
Ryan Tannehill will be the third quarterback drafted this year. Coming out of Texas A&M, he only has 19 starts. I think he's very raw as a passer. He's still got a long way to go. I think it's going to take him until year two, maybe even year three, before he's really comfortable in the pocket. But he's clearly going to go in the top 10. He's got a lot of upside. He's got starter potential. He just got to grow into that position.
Well, no, let me bring it back to the big two, and then we'll start to work our way down the list. You know, you look at Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III. I think they should be 1 and 2. They will be 1 and 2. There's a lot of people still trying to push the possibility that Griffin III jumps in front of Andrew Luck. I just don't see it from the knowledgeable football people that I'm talking to.
From what I was told, Jim Irsay made his decision back in December, and I think he knows which way he's going. I think it's clearly going to be Andrew Luck. You know, he's the successor to Peyton Manning, best player since at that quarterback position. Very tough, extremely intelligent, very hardworking and competitive. He's got everything you want in a quarterback. And, you know, even though Griffin may fit that offense better, they don't have a lot of weapons in Indianapolis right now. The supporting cast is very weak. The offensive line is one of the worst in the league. You know, Luck will be walking into a bad situation, and I think Griffin's a guy that could provide the more immediate spark in that offense and be a more dynamic player. But over the long haul, I don't think you go wrong with Andrew Luck, and I think that's the way that Jim Irsay is going to have to go.
Hey, quick follow-up, though, because we just had a little fun at Mr. Irsay's expense in the last segment, and it's just fun. He's actually a great guy, and he's been very good to the media and Pro Football Weekly. But last December, Ryan Grigson wasn't his GM. Does Ryan have some teeth there? I mean, if Grigson felt strongly, is he in a position to go to Irsay and say, wait a minute, we're making a mistake here?
I think when Bill Polian was pushed out the door, the power went into the hands of the owner. And I think Ryan's there to really line up the board and help him make the decisions. And I think his influence will be greatest from rounds 3 through 7. I think early on in the draft, you know, a lot of times, even around the league, those decisions need the owner's approval. And I think that's clearly going to be Jim Irsay's decision.
All right, Nolan, one last quarterback question. You mentioned the top three, Luck, Griffin, and Tannehill going in that order in the draft. What about number four? Because there are a couple guys I think you could probably juggle here and say, okay, one might be a little better than the other depending on the system. Kirk Cousins, we mentioned, from Michigan State. Brock Osweiler, intriguing tall kid with lots of athleticism from Arizona State. And then Brandon Weeden from Oklahoma State is only going to appeal to certain teams because of his advanced age, because he spent some time in baseball. Where do you, who's going to be the first guy off the board in your opinion, and who do you like the best?
Weeden, to me, is going to be the next off the board. I think Cleveland is looking at him closely with that 22nd pick. And if they don't take a chance there, I think they'll take him off early in the second if they can. You know, Kirk Cousins has a chance. So does Brock Osweiler. Both of them have a lot of upside, a lot of potential. But to me, Weeden is the most ready to come in and start right away. He's got the physical tools, the talent. You worry about his age and, you know, the long-term potential and the risks there. You know, there are some concerns about his arm and, you know, whether it was used too much as a minor league pitcher. But to me, he's the most ready to be a starter of that crew.
You know, guys, I wonder, Osweiler, we talk about Tannehill with 19 starts. Osweiler, I think, had 15. I mean, yeah. To me, he's kind of a poor man's Mark Sanchez. I don't think I'd want him if I was a rich man's Mark Sanchez. He's a fascinating kid. He's 6'7", you know, I guess kind of Josh Freeman in terms of stature. But Nolan, are you really going on anything other than the potential there? You certainly can't, you know much of the production.
I think the upside is what he's going to be drafted on. John Elway, you know, his son, believe it or not, was actually kind of bumped out of his role at Arizona State for Osweiler, and I think that's a good landing spot for him. I think they're looking at him very hard in the late second round, and I don't think he's going to slide very far on draft day. There are other teams that are even interested in the second. I think just like last year when we saw 6 quarterbacks go in the top 36, I think we're going to see a run on quarterbacks, and I think we'll see all 6 come off fairly early.
All right, let's move on to the running back spot. You guys are all jacked about Trent Richardson of Alabama. Matter of fact, a personnel director told me earlier last week that he feels that this prospect out of Alabama is better than Mark Ingram, who came out a year ago, and that's speaking pretty highly of this prospect.
I thought he was better than Ingram the last 3 years. To me, he's a rare talent, second best player in this draft after Andrew Luck. Exceptionally competitive on tape, very strong as a runner, great balance. You got everything you want. I think he could be a bell cow, and he's going to be a great one.
Unfortunately, after that, Nolan, it looks like you got a bunch of late second, third round picks who could go high second. There's nobody else that has a first round grade. David Wilson, Doug Martin, Lamar Miller, Michael James, maybe in that order, maybe not quite in that order, but those four, any of them really jump out at you and get you excited?
Well, I think what the league has really gone to is a committee approach. You need a speed back and you need a power back. And to me, Doug Martin from Boise is the next bell cow. I think Bernard Pierce from Temple is going to get looks in that role as well. And, Lamar Miller from Miami may even fit. I see him as more of a slasher, but I think he could be considered a primary number one back in the league.
You, You know, teams are looking for the Darren Sproles kind of back. Who would best fit that profile? Because he was so effective, obviously, in San Diego and then again last year down in New Orleans. Is there somebody that would fit that for these teams that run a lot of passing, a lot of spread offense on the pro level?
To me, by far the most dynamic is David Wilson from Virginia Tech. I think there's a chance he'll even get looks late in the first round. Definitely could come off early in the second. Very dynamic playmaker. LaMichael James has big-time playability at Oregon. There's just concerns about his durability and his character that could push him down the boards. Cincinnati's Isaiah Pede and Ronnie Hillman from San Diego State. I think both of them will get fairly early looks. Pede's likely to come off somewhere in the late second to third, and I think Hillman will be gone somewhere in the third to fourth.
We preview the wide receivers and tight ends when Pro Football Weekly continues after these messages. Welcome back to this off-season edition of Pro Football Weekly, along with the publisher and editor Hub Arkish, senior editor Eric Edholm, and the Pro Football Weekly staff of editors, including NFL draft expert Nolan Naraki. This is Wayne Larrabee. Let's move on to wide receivers, guys, as we continue to take a look at the offensive side of the football this 2 weeks before the draft. Deep crop of receivers, Nolan, have come out for this draft this spring. Justin Blackmon is considered the best of the quote-unquote Z receivers, which would be a slot receiver in most pro offenses. Tell us a little bit about him, and we were talking off the air that he seems to be a guy whose stock is dropping a little bit of late.
Yeah, there are questions about his maturity, I think, that could affect him. I've talked to teams that said he was the best interview they had, and I've talked to some that are legitimately concerned about the immaturity, some of the issues off the field. So at the end of the day, I think he's still going to be a top six pick. I think there's too many needs at receiver in the top 10, but there's a chance he could slide.
You know, and the other thing about Blackmon that surprised me, I know he wasn't a speed burner, but at 4.56, I guess his timed a little slower than I would have expected.
He clocked in the high 4.4s at his pro day, but he was running on a fast surface, and his workout wasn't exceptionally explosive. You don't see it on tape. He's not real strong in the hips, even though he didn't measure real big either. He had 6'1", 207. So, there are some concerns about just what kind of impact he's going to be able to make.
Nolan, Michael Floyd has answered a lot of questions, sort of in the post-draft circuit a little bit about, speed, character, those kinds of things. Talk about, where he could end up and what you think his ceiling is.
I think he's another one that'll fall in the top 10. He's bigger than Blackmon. He's faster. He's more explosive. And he does have the three alcohol-related incidents in his past. But I think he showed more maturity as a senior. He convinced teams that he's going to put it behind him. He's got an edge to him that they like. And he's got a good chance to go in the top 10.
Ton of great names here as far as talent. Reuben Randall, Kendall Wright, A.J. Jenkins, Alshon Jeffrey, the McNutt kid from Iowa. But I wonder, is it a safe bet that Stephen Hill from Georgia Tech could be the most overdrafted player in this draft?
He quite possibly could. He's got the numbers. You see him at the combine running the way he did, 4.3 time at a big size, nearly 220 pounds. It's hard to find guys like that, and you put him in the class. You look at Jonathan Baldwin from Pittsburgh last year, going 27 late in the first. Those guys tend to get overdrafted when you got numbers.
You know, Nolan, the guy that kind of jumps out at me, and again, down on the list, he's ranked 10th in your wide receiver core. That's Marvin McNutt, as Hub mentioned, from Iowa. He goes 6'2¾". Big hands. I mean, 10-inch hands. That's big for a wide receiver, is it not?
Yeah, he stood out the last 3 years to me for the playmaking ability. You know, there are some concerns about being a little bit too high cut and not extremely polished. But, I've liked what I've seen. I've heard grades anywhere from the second to fifth from evaluators around the league. I think he's going to be a very solid pro, and, I think he'll be a very good Z receiver.
And Nolan really fits the West Coast offense, doesn't he? This is a big receiver. He's got decent speed, but really what he is set up for is the West Coast. Is it not?
It is. He's very strong after the catch. I think he knows how to use his body to shield very well, and I think he'll be a very good pro.
Is it fair to say that Alshon Jeffrey, in terms of his college career, could be one of the most disappointing kids in this group, maybe an underachiever so far?
Well, he played closer to 233 than the 213 that he showed up at his pro day, and he ran well, ran in the high 4.4s, but he didn't show a lot of burst at the top of his routes. Didn't convince evaluators that he's going to be a guy that's going to come to work every day. You look at his body and you see it's very underdeveloped, and you wonder whether he's going to take the next step as a pro.
You know, tight ends, a position that has been maybe undervalued, at least in the college game, with all the spread option offense. You don't see an awful lot of tight end talent, at least not recently. Tell us about this group, and is this the weakest group in this draft?
It absolutely is the weakest. You know, in past years, we've seen as many as 20 tight ends go. It wouldn't surprise me if there were closer to 10 or 12 this year. It's just a disappointing class without a lot of depth. There's only one true potential first-round talent, and that's Kobe Fleener from Stanford. A couple juniors strengthen the class, Orson Charles from Georgia and Dwayne Allen from Clemson, but they both have some concerns off the field, and I think there's a good chance they'll fit into the second round because of how weak this class is.
No one in the last 20 seconds or so. I mean, could you see, is it possible at all that more than one, let's say Fleener, sneaks into the back of the first round of the team like the Giants? Is there any other possibility that any of these guys could end up in round one?
I don't see it. I really think we'll see Fleener at most going in the first, and there's a big drop-off after that.
What, one more kid. What about this Ladarius Green from Louisiana Lafayette? You get a kid 6'5 and a half, 240, running under 4'5 in the 40?
He's got the raw numbers that really excite you. When I watched him coming into the season, I thought he might be able to play the receiver position in the pros. You know, he's a little bit of a hidden gem in this year's class. I think he could potentially be a better pro than college player, and if you use him in the right way, he could be a solid pro.
Coming up, we break down the offensive line of the upcoming NFL draft. Stay tuned. Pro Football Weekly continues after these messages. Welcome back to our draft edition of Pro Football Weekly, along with Hub Arkush, Eric Edholm, Nolan Araki, the senior editor and author of Pro Football Weekly's draft preview book. I'm Wayne Larrabee. We move to the offensive line in this draft, and coming up, Nolan, one of the things about the line that you have to understand first is that in some offenses, some of these tackles will be guards, and in other offenses, some guards could be centers. But best as you can see right now, let's start with the tackle position, and everybody seems to be talking about USC's Matt Khalil as the next great offensive lineman out of SC. Iowa's Riley Reiff, and Iowa's produced some very good offensive tackles in recent years. Those two seem to headline the category.
Yeah, I think they're very clearly the top two left tackle prospects in this year's draft. There are some concerns about whether Reiff has the length and the foot quickness to stay on the left side. I think he could do it, but he may be the best in the pros as a guard. Khalil, to me, is a bona fide left tackle. He doesn't have elite feet for the left side. You might want to play him on the right side, but he can play on either side. He's as good as they come in this year's class. He really grows on you the more you watch him on tape. Just very consistent in his overall approach.
No, and what is it about the University of Wisconsin? I mean, I guess it's obviously their theory. It's their program. It's the way they build a team. But you've got Gabe Creamy came out last year in the first round of tackle. This year, your fourth offensive guard is Kevin Zeitler out of Wisconsin. And you've got the rare, probably first-round center in Peter Kahns.
Yeah, they just produce them year after year. I think that's what they do best at Wisconsin. They know how to run the ball, and they develop offensive linemen that can create movement in the running game. And that's what Zeitler does. Very strong, very physical. I think he'll walk in from day one and be a starter. He could even get looks late in the first round.
I had a conversation, Nolan, with Pep Hamilton, the offensive coordinator at Stanford a couple months ago. I was talking about Andrew Luck, but it came around to the offensive linemen. They've got two highly rated guys, Jonathan Martin and David DeCastro. And every time I try to talk about Martin, he'd always switch the conversation to DeCastro, expected to be the top guard taken in this draft. You've compared him to Steve Hutchinson. Pep Hamilton said he's a lot like Olin Krutz. Now, he's a center, but one of the nastiest guys in the trenches in the league. I mean, does he fit that mold of a guy who should be worth taking in the top 20?
He's absolutely every bit worth it. I think he's one of the few guards that you can consider in the top 15. We really haven't seen any in the last 15 years. Mike Iupati from San Francisco went 17 overall, but there's a good chance DeCastro will come off in that 10 to 15 range, just very tough, very nasty. Might even be able to play center in the league like Krutz. So it's a solid comparison from the standpoint of his temperament and football playing demeanor.
What happened to Mike Adams out of Ohio State? You know, at the end of his at the college season, I heard him talked about top 10, top 15. He went to the combine, he tanked it, and he's really dropping probably as much as anybody in this draft.
If you look at his overall play history, I think it's very inconsistent. One thing you want in the offensive line is a guy you can trust consistently on an everyday basis, and he has not shown that throughout his career. Did not interview very well in the process. Comes from a entitled background, a little bit too spoiled, and I think there's some concerns about the way he's wired, just his general makeup. So I think that could push him down the board. So, you know, if I were a team looking, I wouldn't be looking in the third round, maybe even the fourth for a player like Adams, but there's a good chance he could still go in the first.
You know, let's go back to the center position, and Peter Kahn's out of Wisconsin. This is, sounds to me like this is a kid who has some upside about him. He's a bigger player at the center position, but he's also got good feet, a finesse, kind of considered a finesse player, though he is a player of good size at that position and would probably be able to fit into a zone blocking scheme. And that's a lot of what Wisconsin did, wasn't it?
It is. It's exactly what they did, and I think that's where he could excel. He came out at the combine and disappointed by only bench pressing 225 pounds 18 times, and I think he's still got to show more strength and development in his future to really become more of a true power player.
But you know what? Some of these teams that that don't need him to start right away, he could be a guy who might be able. You can develop that. You can get a guy stronger in the weight room. There's no question about that. And this guy seems to have some upside in that regard. So if you don't have to start him right away, he might be a real good prospect down the road.
And I think somebody will draft him high enough that they're going to be looking to start him right away. There's not a lot of solid prospects in this center class overall. I think there's four that could get thrust into starting roles sooner than later. And you look at Michigan's David Mulkey would be one of them, Ben Jones from Georgia, and Phillip Blake from Baylor, who's drawn some comparisons to Chris Spencer, the former first-round pick, who has turned out to be a better swing player in the pros.
And Nolan, one of the more fascinating players, and I give you a lot of props because you've been talking about this kid for 6 months or more, but Amini Silatalu, a kid from Midwestern State in Texas. And we've seen some small school guys. And you mentioned Mike Upati. Jari Evans is a perennial Pro Bowl guy. Jared Veld here, you know, and Todd Harriman's. People have come from some strange places, out of the way places. Is this kid in that class of the small school guy who could be dominant in the pros?
I would definitely put him in that class. If you watch the tape, it's hard not to get excited. He just plays such a physical brand of football, dominates a smaller level of competition, tough, physical, nasty. I think he walks in right away. The one question you got to figure out is whether he's going to be able to handle the offense. But if you keep things simple for him, protect him, and don't ask too much of him, I think he's going to be an outstanding pro.
Senior editor Nolan Oraki, the author of the Pro Football Weekly Draft Preview. The Publisher's Pen is next. The Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkush. Hub?
You know, Wayne, an interesting story I thought that kind of slipped by quietly about a week and a half or two ago. As part of the offshoot of the Saints Bounty Program, as people wondered, will Bill Parcells come back or not? Now, Parcells is elected to stay retired. I maintain it's more because of uncertainty about how many players off the Saints defense they might lose due to suspension, a ruling that has not come down yet from Roger Goodell so much that he didn't want to get back into the game. And so you start to ask yourself, what is going on there? Because DeMaurice Smith, the head of the NFL Players Association, took that opportunity to fire hard at the league office and accuse them of not sharing information with the Players Association while allegedly waiting for the Players Association to make recommendations on how they should be dealt with. And what it really uncovered was that there obviously is still some bad blood, some feelings really strained minimally between Smith and the NFL Management Council and Roger Goodell, and possibly between the players and the owners. The bottom line is the owners took the players to the woodshed on this 10-year CBA, and now you've got kind of a toothless DeMaurice Smith wondering, well, what do I do? What am I leading here? What are my options? He got a chance to get in the news. He took a shot at Goodell. The reality is Roger Goodell runs the NFL with an iron fist right now, and nobody's going to be able to challenge it.
Thanks very much, Hub. That'll do it for Pro Football Weekly this week. The coordinating producer and engineer of Pro Football Weekly is Randy Meyer. Pro Football Weekly originates from the studios of Syndication Networks in Chicago, Illinois. For Hub Arkush, Eric at home, Nolan Naraki, and the Pro Football Weekly staff, this is Wayne Larrabee. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week on Pro Football Weekly.